Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, he's not the yin to my yang, but he's more the skip to my sprang, it's Dan. How are you doing this evening, Dan?
Today is just one of those, like, you know, some, you know, just like your day, some day, some good, some bad, whatever, blah.
Yes, I had one of those little, I don't know if I'd call it a roller coaster day. It wasn't, perhaps the highs and lows weren't that extreme, but, you know, it was one of those, I'm not sure what to make of it. It's kind of, but it did leave me exhausted at the end of it. But this is our Fargo podcast, but we did once again delay it only by a day, but for a pretty good reason, I would say. Why don't you fill us in on why we waited a day to get to the Fargo podcast, Dan?
Yeah, a few weeks ago, one of our friends who's been on the show before, Curtis, texted me and said that my favorite movie of all time, the 1958 Alfred Hitchcock movie Vertigo, was going to be playing in a theater in his town, and he sent me a link and stuff like that. And it was only going to play last night and tomorrow night, one showing each night. So I decided I needed to go see that, since I'd never, I mean, before that, I'd never even been to a movie in the theater that, like, you know, wasn't first run or anything. So it was definitely a cool experience, which I basically experienced, you know, by myself. There was two people in the theater besides me, so.
I'm actually more jealous of that than anything else.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't mind.
I know people like the movie-going communal experience, but I also enjoy being in theater, like, totally alone. So I would make a great, you know, rich freak, like Howard Hughes or something like that. Plus, you know, I don't mind peeing in jars either, for that matter.
Yeah, it was pretty sweet. So I'll definitely have to make an effort to try to see some more of my favorite films in the theater that I haven't had the chance to, if I get the opportunity. It just requires me driving 2 or 3 hours to a town where, like, you know, it's not just infested with stupid redneck ho-dunk shit fucks. So
that didn't take long. Yeah, there is something special about seeing older films on a big screen, and a legitimately big screen, not like some, you know, bullshit digital projected, you know, overblown TV screen or something, which I've sat through that too, which is like, this is like just being at someone's house who's got a really good TV, which annoys me.
But yeah, like I sent you guys a picture of, like, I took a picture at the beginning of the big VistaVision logo on the screen. It's just like, you know, just cool. It just represents, like, how, like, awesome it kind of is. I'm trying to, you know, channel what it was like back then.
Well, what's great about seeing something like a Vertigo, and, you know, Vertigo is definitely one of my favorite films also, although for some reason there are still a few Hitchcock movies I prefer to it, but as you know, since you've been to my house, you know, way back when, as I sit here recording this podcast and I look up, the poster that's hanging above me is Vertigo. So it's definitely a movie that's I'm partial to. But there's something great about seeing a classic film which was made to be seen on a big screen. And some of these films, you know, very big screens, quite frankly. You know, I think one of my favorite movie-going experiences, which was in a strange place, was at Brooklyn College. And probably one, when I tell you about it, you would be infinitely jealous of me for, perhaps even more so than seeing Vertigo on a big screen. I went to a special screening of Lawrence of Arabia. And it was I was shocked that I didn't know Brooklyn College had such a massive screen. It was your classic, you know, curtains parting, gigantic screen. And it was just a beautifully restored version of it. And I had actually never seen it before. I'd only seen bits of it. Well, this is like 20 something years ago. So,
yeah. You know.
But I was stunned by it. And when I saw it, my first thought was, this movie doesn't make sense to watch at home. It's just, I mean, I know people have to, we all do, but when you see it on a big screen, you realize, oh, that, but it was meant for a big screen. You know, so it's great when there are revival houses that either they're a few hours or a few blocks away from you. It's that you have the opportunity to see films the way they were originally meant to be seen. So it's a great opportunity. I hope you do get to see some other films like that. Right. It's especially ones that have such scope to them, you know, like a Vertigo. I mean, your mind will be blown if you ever get to see a Sergio Leone film on
oh,
the big
man.
Screen, because you know that those are meant to be, you know, like 70mm kind of deals, kind of things.
Yeah, I can just imagine. And you had good timing too with Lawrence of Arabia, because I think it was restored. I mean, it couldn't have been much before when you saw it. So that's pretty sweet.
Yeah, it was the big news that we were seeing the restored version of it. So it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
But anyway, I just thought it would be nice to fill people in on what you were doing, especially because it's relating to a movie so very cool like Vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
But let's switch gears here, go from a cool movie to one of the coolest shows that I've seen in years, Fargo. So we're up to the latest episode. I'm going to confess that I'm probably going to have an issue saying the title of this episode, because that's when my self-consciousness about any lisp I have, and I know I've got one, God knows I've never been able to get rid of it, it's really going to come into play. So apologies if it sounds like someone's letting air out of a tire or there's snakes invading your ears. No, it's just my lisp out of control because of the title. This episode is not something I prefer saying, quite frankly. Do you know what the title is, or do I need? I'll just make you say the title each time. I'll say it. I'll give it a shot. The title of the latest episode was "The Myth." Myth alone is not great for me. Because now that I'm self-conscious, I'm going to blow every word I say tonight. You know.
Yeah. I'll try to spit it out here. The Myth of Sisyphus.
Right. The Myth. Oh, God, what's wrong? The Myth of... What you just said. Anyway. Holy crap. See, once you're thinking about it, then you can't do it. It's like one of those things, if you think about anything that you normally don't have to think about doing, suddenly you'll find, oh, I can't do it. I don't know how to pee anymore or something. To explain the title for anyone out there who doesn't know what that is referring to, that is a very well-known, you know, legendary, not that word, myth again, it was about the king of Corinth, actually another place, but it became known as Corinth years later, who was condemned to roll a boulder up a hill, only to constantly see it come rolling back down again. And that punishment, and this, because he was kind of like a vain, egotistical, it's all about him kind of a guy, kind of a jerk, kind of, wow, he could be on our podcast, actually. And that's probably more me than you, quite frankly. But this punishment was to go on for eternity. So just basically roll that stone up the hill, only to watch it come right back down again. So that's the title of the episode. Now, obviously, they don't make a direct reference to that specific story, so you have to look at the episode and decide, who is it they're talking about? What is it supposed to represent? I mean,
I think they're just talking about my love life. Even though, to be honest, I probably would actually enjoy rolling a boulder up a hill. But
all right, don't wait till the podcast is over before we start bumming people out. Nah, it's fine. Actually, I believe they're talking about, you know, our ostensibly our main character, Lou Salverson. Maybe just because of all the crap he's gone through in his life and is continuing to deal with. I mean, that's as close as it gets. And it's a little, maybe it's even a little bit on the nose, quite frankly. You know, everything from the horrors of war he dealt with to the fact his wife is, you know, well, she's dying of cancer. You know, hopefully she'll make it through it, but it's cancer. And we already kind of know she's going to die just because I think we know that. And, you know, and just even dealing with this case and how he seems to keep running into people who don't have quite the, I wouldn't say respect, but or fear of law enforcement that he is more accustomed to. I mean, obviously we'll get to that later, but I'm guessing that's really what they're talking about with the title here. So Without any further lispy preamble, let's just get right to the actual episode. We open, it's another somewhat quirky opening for an episode, much like I think the very first episode had kind of a strange opening. This time we open with Hansi, I think you told me his name was, because he's like one character's name I tend to forget for some reason. It's Dodd's main guy. He's sitting in this snowy forest with this big rabbit in his arms. And we get this flashback to his youth. Obviously it's a classroom. Looks like they're all Native Americans there. And there's a magician doing a trick in front of them with a rabbit. And we're watching this and I'm like going, okay, what's the point of this? Because moments later, when we see him with the rabbit, we hear a little off-screen crack, and then we see him walking back towards the compound with a dead rabbit in his hands. My only guess about that is to show with this character that you may think it's possible for him to have some sort of sentimentality, and that he has a past, and he might look at things that may be innocent or beautiful or whatever. It doesn't mean anything to him because he'll still do what has to be done. And I'm kind of thinking that could be a foreshadowing of him killing someone else who might be the quote unquote rabbit in a later episode.
Yeah, otherwise, I kind of took it as just like a symbolic thing about, because with his little flashback, that was him in one of those like bullshit Indian re-education like school things. So, he must have been one of those things. And those things are just, I'm way against them, so I better just stop before I get into swearing. But I'm sure it was just like symbolic, shedding away that kind of bullshit.
Right. So also, like they have in previous episodes, we also had this little quick, I guess I call it a cross-cutting montage, which they use with split screens. It always feels like they're just doing that more than anything else to remind us about who all these characters are, where they are at this point in time, just kind of catching us up with everybody in these little split seconds before we resume the story. I guess I kind of like that, actually. It's different that they're doing that. So you can't say we're waiting like 10 or 15 minutes to see where somebody is. No, we saw them for a few seconds in that little montage. Otherwise, I have no idea why you do that other than it being a style choice, I guess.
Yeah, I like the way they do that and the way they kind of show they'll show the same character doing two different things, so there's a little bit of progression too, and that's kind of nice.
Yeah, I really enjoy the fact they've done that throughout this episode, and I guess they probably did it in previous episodes as well, because it's kind of informing us just a little bit more about the character. Also, it's showing, and I think at times it's showing like their true self and what they may be projecting to others as well in some of those moments. So those are choices I'm enjoying, and it kind of makes me want to see a breakdown of the script to see how much of this. And no, the reason why I'm saying that is because there are some things you'll see. Most things you see in a film or a TV show are fully scripted, and there are decisions that are made afterwards. It may not be in the actual script, but the decisions both the director and the editor make. Now, I don't know how much of the split screen stuff was determined at the script stage or if it was decisions that were made later on. So that's why I find that interesting. I'm kind of curious about that, because that kind of stuff is kind of annoying and not really fun to write when you're in script writing mode. So not that I really know. No, I'm just kidding. I guess I wouldn't know a little bit.
Yeah, but I definitely like the way they do stuff like that in this show. It kind of has this show is a lot darker than the ones I'm going to mention, but, like Psych or It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, where you can just tell they're just if they want to do an episode where they just do something fucking ridiculous, they're just going to do it. And it's just part of the they don't quite have somebody sitting over them just saying, oh, you better not do that. Look at my awesome fucking suit and attaché case here. We've got to look what our sponsors are going to do. They're just like, no, somebody's just letting them do whatever the fuck they want, and they're doing it well. So I enjoy seeing that kind of creative freedom, because we don't see that as much as we'd like to.
No, we don't. We definitely don't. Another thing I think it functions as, those little moments of with the split screens and the cross-cutting and whatever, it's a show that can at times, unless we're following someone driving, as we do with like Lou Salverson a few times and other characters at different times, the show can at times be a little static because it's, you know, it's it's very dialogue heavy, which we love because I think if there's one thing we love on this show, it's the dialogue. I mean, we will be trust me, I will be quoting a couple scenes later on, which, you know, it doesn't do them justice unless we actually get the lines out, not to try to do some little poorly written paraphrasing on my part. But what's interesting about these devices that they're doing with the little cross-cut montage, whatever we call them, it gives the illusion of motion. It gives the illusion of pushing ahead, even if it's not necessarily doing that. But it's making you feel that way because it's kind of giving you a little bit of a boost. It's a jump start, so to speak, which again, I think is a great choice by the director, especially because you have moments like that, and then you also have a show which has how many standoffs or confrontations, or you know, and those don't have movement in them. So it's very much a director's choice. Mm-hmm. So let's get to one of those first conversations. We see the Gerhardts, and it's pretty much, you know, all the main family members. You got your Bear, you got your Dodge, you got Floyd. I don't think the kid comes in during it. I don't think the kid is there initially. Is it Charlie? Is that the kid's name?
I think he's just sitting off doing a thing.
Oh, of course. How can I forget? And Otto is there. I have to say, I'm so pleased that I was wrong, that they didn't kill him off right off the bat. I think it's hysterical that he may actually show up in every episode. What's the actor's name? I mean, I know he's Colonel Ty.
Michael Hogan.
Michael Hogan, thank you. If that man manages to get a paycheck for acting just with his stricken face for 10 episodes, more power to him, and without an eye patch. So I'm loving that he's still there. So the Gerhardts, they're meeting with, let's call them the distributors, since they keep using the phrase distributors and distributing in all three episodes. It's not just the Gerhardts. Other people have used that phrase as well. But, you know, they're the people they deal with as far as getting out whatever it is they're pushing or dealing with out there. I think I'm still... I know I mentioned it last week. I'm still not totally, truly clear on it, but it's fine. I'm still not sure what it is that they're doing. By the way, they do talk about Otto a little bit. You know, trying to figure out what's going on with him. I love that Bear thanks them for their cards and letters, and Dodd is like, gets pissed off about that because he just wants to talk about going to war because he feels that they're under siege. Floyd, who is the mom, but I always feel like I got to remind everyone it's the mom when I say Floyd, because Floyd doesn't sound like a woman's name, of course. But she's more on the reluctant side, but she points out this is the Kansas City Mafia, and, you know, comparatively speaking, they're small time. I love Bear. Bear agrees with her and says, you know thyself. And Dodd again is like bewildered at his brother. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about? And he's, you know, I think he mentions that he's quoting the Bible, although, like, I think everyone knows the phrase, know thyself. But she points out that she will go to war, but it's only as a last resort. And now the three guys that they're talking to, who I call the distributors, and by the way, and I don't have the greatest ear for accents and dialects that some people have. So I will confess that even though I know the region that these characters are supposed to be from, and I can't imagine they would screw that up because, you know, they have to get stuff like that correct. Was it just me? Am I stupid? Or I thought at the very least the middle guy, the guy who does the bulk of the talking, he had a very Chicago-sounding accent to me, but maybe it's just somewhat similar to a Minnesota accent, perhaps? You're very familiar with this region, obviously. Did it sound right to you, or am I crazy, or what?
Yeah, you know, like the Chicago voice is more of like the usual Minnesota voice, and then like the crazy, like, you know, Fargo, the movie voices is more of like the more like intense Scandinavian, like, you know, almost the caricature of that type of person. So
Okay. All right.
But the Chicago accent's like, you know, pretty standard. I mean, hell, is probably how I fucking sound.
Yeah, you sound normal. Well, that's doesn't really make sense to say you sound normal, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, not me.
No. But there, because I thought these guys were, they were talking like this, and these distributors. I started thinking, it's a Saturday Night Live sketch all of a sudden. They say that they will not make the first move. Because Floyd is trying to find out if they're going to stand with them if they end up having to go up against the KC Mafia. But I like the one guy who says, but if those Kansas City mooks come at them shooting, they're going to cut their goddamn nose off their faces. I know. I kept thinking he reminded me of something that Dennis Farina would have said. He had a very Dennis Farina-like quality to him, that voice-wise. That's what I was thinking. And that was my tribute to Dennis Farina in that horrible impression I just did. So after that, we see Joe Buell. That's the Brad Garrett character, for anyone who's forgotten his name. He's meeting with Mike Milligan. Can I say one of my first favorite moments in the episode is that you have these two guys who are two of the many quote-unquote villains of the show, I guess, and they're having a conversation about their hair and shampoo. And Agree, of all things. And I remember Agree shampoo. I actually think I might have used it when I was a kid.
not to get too sidetracked here, but once you mentioned the KC Mafia, I just checked and the Royals tied it up in the ninth inning somehow, so now they're in extra innings. Game one of the World Series talk, people. So.
Excellent. And that may or may not be the extent of baseball interruptions, but I'm sure now if you spot that someone actually takes the lead and wins, we will mention that as well. Just to further timestamp the length of our podcast. I actually do have it on in the other room, but it's my back is to the TV. I don't really have a strong rooting interest here. I don't hate the Mets, although I'm a Yankee fan. I don't care much for Met fans, but I don't care much for Yankee fans. So it doesn't really matter. I do have some friends who are Met fans, and also I even know a couple of people who or one person who actually works for them, and they're lovely people. So I kind of want to root for the Mets just for those guys. But on the other hand, I wouldn't mind seeing the Royals win. So I'll be happy with whoever wins that series.
I'm leading the Royals a little bit. I mean, they're in the same division as the Twins, but they've never really struck me as like douchey and like, or their fans just being assholes, like the White Sox fans or the Detroit fans or whatever. I root for them a little bit.
And let us just emphasize the White Sox fans in case she should ever listen to this.
Yes.
Anyway, we should probably get back to the show because.
I know one White Sox fan that isn't annoying as fuck. The rest of them, they're just terrible.
She'll never listen.
Yes.
So let's get back to the show because I know a few people who watch Fargo who have no interest in baseball. So let me get back to this. who actually listen to our podcast, amazingly enough. So who were we talking about? Oh, the scene with Brad Garrett and Bukim Woodbine, or should I say Joe Buell and Mike Milligan. I like that. He keeps, Joe Buell, that is, he keeps referring to Floyd Gerhardt as the Frau. Did you notice that? He refers to her as the Frau at least like three or four times. But basically, they haven't heard anything yet from the Gerhardts, but that's to be expected. You know, they feel that they're probably going to stall and then pass on the deal. So Milligan assumes that means they're just going to kill them. But then Joe says, no, it depends on what the market dictates. And he keeps using the phrase, you know, market forces, the market dictates whether they should kill them or whether they should offer them more money. Obviously, on one hand, that's a phrase people have heard of. You know, it's, you know, kind of a well-known, whatever the market dictates. I don't know, is he referring to management that way or fate? I'm not – it was a very strange phrase to use, I thought.
Yeah, well, it just, you know, I mean, he was kind of the one giving, like, the, you know, the whatever they have to do against the Gerhardts, and, you know, it's kind of like an economically structured presentation in the first episode, so it just seems like he's, like, the guy crunching some, like, you know, goofy old 70s computer trying to figure out the best way to, you know, make $1.10 or dollar into $1.10.
Yeah, and he is approaching everything from more of a business point view. I think he does even use the phrase he'd prefer to save the bullets. And I think he meant from a financial perspective. And also, to a certain extent, I kept thinking, you know, he's kind of got a bit more in common with Gene Smart's character, with Floyd Gerhardt, than I thought. Or they're both definitely the heads of what they're doing here. They finally discuss Rye, the still missing in action guy, Rye Gerhardt. I mean, we know what happened to him, because now they know that he's killed that judge. But they, of course, like everyone else, seem to think he's on the run. So the key is that they're going to find him to try to use him as leverage. Now, in his patrol car, we see Officer Lou, or Lou Salverson. He gets a call patched through to him from Sheriff Larson, the Ted Danson character. Although I think the line was delivered, it was a little, I think he... It sounded like he had been to Fargo when, in fact, he was en route to Fargo. But he's going to Fargo to find out about that dead judge's caseload because he's looking for a connection to her shooter. And he finds out from, you know, Sheriff Larson that they actually identified a print off that gun they found, and it was Rye Gerhardt. So Lou says he'll mention it to Fargo PD. And then we then see Lou showing up in what I assumed was the courthouse where the different judges have their chambers and offices and whatnot. And he meets a man named Ben Schmidt, who, based on what he's wearing, the impression I'm getting is that he's supposed to be a detective in Fargo, right?
Yeah.
So this is the point where I wanted to stop for 1 second. Actually, I don't need to stop. Just wanted to fill in folks who might not have realized this. Ben Schmidt is a character that we've seen before. Ben Schmidt is in season one of Fargo. Okay, so now some of you might be going, what? Yes, he's in season one. You'll recall Colin Hanks' character, Gus Grimley. He had a boss who finds out about Gus failing to, you know, go after Malvo when he should have, and that could have led to all the things that have gone wrong. That boss is Ben Schmidt. He even makes a comment, and you can find this online, about this being Sioux Falls all over again in season one when he finds that out from Gus Grimley. So it's funny that I thought the only characters from season one that we'd see would be Lou Salverson and Molly, but it turns out there may be others that I should probably keep my eyes and ears open for, because this character does appear in a number of episodes in season one as well.
Nice.
Okay, so let's get back to 1979. When Schmidt hears Rye Gerhardt's name, he then, you know, other than freaking out a little bit, because it's probably the last people he wants to deal with, he tells Lou a little bit of history about the Gerhardt family. We've kind of gotten this history lesson already, but I do love that he had this analogy about how, I guess, the original patriarch of the family was Dieter, and then he ended up leaving the legacy to his son Otto, and he compared it to, well, it was like the World War I ending, and then say hello to Adolf Hitler. So I got a kick out of that. But Schmidt, apparently, he may know about the Gerhardts, but he doesn't seem to have ever heard of either Mike Milligan or the Kitchen Brothers when Lou asks him about them. He tells him that they're out of Kansas City. At this point, we do also find out that both these guys are veterans of the Vietnam War. And, you know, we get that little bit about FUBAR, which anyone who's seen any war movie in the last 30 years has probably heard the phrase, and you don't need me to tell you what FUBAR means, unless Dan would like to spell it out, because it features words he likes to use on podcasts.
Yeah, I'll save my swearing for anger instead of...
Yeah, we all know what it means. Wait, is it beyond all recognition? Right, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, just making sure I actually did know what all the letters stood for. So it means fracked up beyond all recognition. That's a salute to Michael Hogan. At that point, I think we might have gone to commercial, but when we come back, we see Hansi talking to Dodd's daughter.
Before we go ahead, I really like the line where he just said, like, you know, after knowing who's involved in it, he just wants to, like, you know, take credit for killing the judge himself, just so he doesn't have to, like, be involved.
I forgot about that. Yeah, that is pretty good. Yeah. Schmidt, while I wouldn't call him an out-and-out coward, he's not the most courageous of policemen, let's put it that way. Which, again, if you really reach back into your memory banks, he wasn't exactly that way in season one either, which is kind of funny. Okay, where was I? So Hansi is talking to Dodd's daughter, who I later figured out, I think her name is Simone. They're talking about Rye, and he's trying to figure out a place where maybe he goes to, quote unquote, do his business. And as she puts it, what, like, nail girls and do drugs? Huh. And apparently she's a little bit of a wild child, maybe because she's got a father who doesn't want her to do anything. Although he seems to allow her to dress in a rather provocative style. I like the fact that Hansi mentions that if anybody sells her drugs, his father's going to take an axe to them. And I believe he's being serious. I don't think it's just a turn of a phrase. I genuinely believe that character will kill anyone who gives her drugs with an axe.
And I got the impression that he did it. He's probably already done it a couple times. This is what happens. Yeah.
This is the life. I love that character so much. He's not even in this scene, and I love that character. So she eventually tells him of a place that Ryan does go to. Oh, by the way, while she's talking, Hansi is very busy gutting and skinning that rabbit that he caught before, and even chewing on little bits of it. We get a quick moment of seeing Sheriff Larson looking at pictures of Rye, I guess, that are on the wanted poster that they're putting up around town, as well as photos of the bloody knife. I believe that was the knife that the judge had planted in his back during the whole diner bloodbath fiasco. But now we're in downtown. Is it? That's Luverne where they are, where all the shops are, right? Luverne, yes. Minnesota? Okay. There was a song on the soundtrack, and I was having a heck of a time trying to track it down online last night. I didn't try it tonight. Maybe I could find it. I thought it might have been Elvis. I wasn't sure. It had a shot at being our song at the end of the podcast until I decided otherwise. But it was kind of a nice song.
I enjoyed it.
But we meet up with Betsy Salverson. She's at the salon with Constance. And, of course, Peggy Blomquist. Initially, it's as light a conversation as you can have about potentially losing your hair from chemo. And Peggy's also decided to go to the Life Spring seminar. So it's all very light and nice and kind of, filling up time, quite frankly. But then Sheriff Larson shows up with flyers of Rye Gerhardt. And I like that during this conversation between Larson and his daughter, Betsy, you see Peggy is just sleeping, rather nervously listening. And again, I think we've mentioned this in one or both podcasts, Betsy is maybe one of the most astute people on the whole show, because she's already theorizing about maybe why they can't find him, is that maybe there was a hit and run. And she starts laying out a whole scenario, which is pretty much what happened. She's got a little bit of a Holmes Columbo thing going on there. But Peggy feels the need to try to shoot it down because, why wouldn't they stop, to help the person if they hit him? And of course, they have a little wink at us with Sheriff Larson agreeing and saying, it's not like someone's going to drive home with a Gerhardt sticking out of their windshield and then just start supper. I was like, yeah. Which is exactly what she did, of course. Instantly after that, Peggy's kind of freaked out. She goes to get Ed, who's, I guess he's across the street at the butcher shop or wherever the heck they're located. But she just keeps repeating over and over, they got a theory. They got a theory now. We got to do something about the car. And we end the scene with Ed seeing the flyer in the window and just looking stunned. So when we come back, we have this brief moment, and I could sit and try to do some analysis why it's there, but I'm not going to waste that much time. We get this brief glimpse of Molly watching a movie called Operation Eagle's Nest. It's just there. It's like, I don't know, 20 seconds tops before we dissolve her to something else. I'm not really clear why it's there. Again, it might be one of those things I could start coming up with theories other than them just being cute.
Yeah, it might be some kind of foreshadowing, like maybe they're going to have some kind of a, you know, maybe they're foreshadowing like the Gerhards are going to like, you know, kill themselves or something. I don't know.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, obviously this episode is peppered with different war references, everything from Vietnam to, like I said, you know, the World War One and World War Two kind of stuff. So it's interesting having the one character who probably should not be watching, you know, a war. And I don't even know if that's a movie or a documentary she's watching. It's not really that clear.
Yeah, I haven't heard of the movie. I mean, I know the Eagle's Nest was Hitler's bunker, but I'm not. You know, right. I got the impression it was, you know, one of those movies, you know, like Audie Murphy or somebody, like, you know, storming the nest, trying to.
I'm assuming it's a takeoff on one of those, much like the way the season began with that movie, the Ronald Reagan movie, which doesn't actually exist. You know, they just made up a movie. So I'm assuming that's the case here as well. So we're back in Fargo, and we see we're in that courthouse, and Lou is watching this one guy going back and forth, about to go into a room, walks away, about to go in, walks away, and then we realize, oh, that's the typewriter guy. So then we finally get to find out what his name is, and apparently what I read. And I blame IMDb. They apparently misidentified him because they had him listed as Mr. Watson. That's not his name. His name is Skip Sprang, which I love the name Skip Sprang. I love alliteration to begin with. And I love that both his first and last name are, you know, versions. Well, one's a verb and one's a past tense of a verb or something. I love that's his name. So anyway, yeah, Lou and Schmidt kind of question him a little bit at the in his car before Schmidt ultimately just decides to let him go. I like that Lou refers to him as a squirrely, you know, a little squirrely fella. Because when he said that, I kept thinking, is that a reference to a line from Fargo? It was driving me crazy. And then I realized I think the line I was thinking of, and it doesn't mean they didn't use the word squirrely in Fargo. I'm not sure if they did or they didn't. But I was thinking of how people keep referring to Steve Buscemi's character as a little fella, kind of funny looking. Like, that was almost going to be the introduction that I decided not to go with it for our podcast tonight. I was also wondering in the moment when Schmidt let him go instead of, you know, whatever, continuing to question him or do something more. I remember thinking, oh gosh, could this be the mistake like what Gus does in season one that leads to some sort of massacre? So we know what it leads to at the very end, but I guess it wasn't quite as egregious a mistake as I thought it might have been. But we continue to follow Skip, and he shows up at that place that Simone was about to tell Hansi about that we didn't hear about. In fact, she's there, and she's in total bad girl mode. And you can see Skip, who really shouldn't be thinking he has a shot with anyone, quite frankly. Like, oh, all right, I'm freaking out. My life may be on the line, but oh, I'll go for a little bit of this. And when he walks in, too bad, Skip. Guess what? Hansi is there, too. You know, the rabbit skinner. So Simone, kind of, I think we find out pretty clearly in the scene, she's kind of smart too, because she knows that this is the guy that Ryan must have been making references to, some sort of partner in a deal. So they decide that they're all going to go for a ride. And speaking of referencing a line or a phrase that we heard so many times in the movie, of all people, Hansi says, "You betcha." So We then switch to seeing Ed and Peggy Blomquist, and they're about to move forward with their plan to, you know, take care of the car. She feels that's their one loose end because, you know, the guy, you know, he's all ground up. I love that she's so matter of fact about the fact that the guy is ground up into chop meat, essentially. And his, you know, his clothes are burned, you know, so once the car is fixed, they're free. And I was thinking, hey, wait a minute. Didn't your boss see your car like days earlier with a big hole in the windshield and everything? So there actually still is a loose end out there. You know, I still think Constance is going to get killed off and possibly by Peggy in this season. So we'll see if I'm right or not about that. But again, she's the influencer on Ed. And, you know, she even refers to him as her paladin. And she's not referring to the great Western TV show from the 60s that no one will know what I'm talking about. She's just referring to him as a knight, her knight. So the plan is that he's going to smash the car into a tree that they went out of their way to select, you know, on this abandoned or deserted road somewhere. And of course, as luck would have it, because, you know, it's icy, he's trying to smack it into a tree, but the car skids around almost in a complete arc, and the back hits the tree, which is really not what they had in mind or needed. Apparently, they do eventually get it right, I guess, the second time. We don't get to see that. But we do see the car being towed away, and apparently he gave himself a little bit of whiplash doing that. So we're back with the Gerhardts, and Bear is with his son, and so we have a little bit of a father-son conversation because he wants him to go back to school. I like that everything that Bear says, he has to make it clear that Grandma agrees with him. So, you know, because he still views her as the authority figure. And even though he clearly can take care of business himself, it's interesting that he feels he needs her to kind of reinforce what he's saying to be, you know, you need to do this because, and Grandma agrees, as though his own son wouldn't listen to him, which is an interesting choice there. But then we get, and I really didn't even write notes for this part, because I figured we'd just chat about it. Salverson and Schmidt do show up at the Gerhardt compound. And we get the first of a couple, I don't know if we should call them showdowns or standoffs, or this is more of a showdown. What happens later on is a standoff, I guess. This was one of my favorite scenes in the episode. And definitely kind of picked up as far as tension was. Especially when Dodd shows up. It's not, did you enjoy this scene as much as I did? Because there was so much to enjoy here, I thought.
Yeah, it was the whole thing was just great, and it really was nice. I mean, this whole episode letting Dodd and Bear grow a little bit, you know, just it's always so important in a show with such a big cast. So it really felt like they were doing good setting up this and that. And the scene was a lot of fun.
I also enjoyed the fact that they're really giving Patrick Wilson some good work to do here. Because one of the core things about the scene is that in this part of the country, in this part of the state, being a cop don't mean much. You know, all these guys, guards and whatnot, they all still got their guns trained on them. In fact, they're telling them that they have to give up their guns initially, even though Slew is like, excuse me? Like, I don't... He has a line or something like that. I don't know how you people treat law enforcement, you know, around here, but where I come from, you know, you talk when a cop tells you to talk, and then so on and so forth. It's kind of – we saw that a little bit with the sheriff and Milligan and the Kitchen Brothers in the previous episode, a similar kind of a situation. This was, you know – I didn't actually think anything was really bad was going to happen in this moment. I thought something differently in a later moment, maybe. But when Dodd shows up, and it was great to see couldn't get two more opposite sort of characters together, Salverson and Dodd. I gotta figure that these two are going to have some sort of a showdown again at some point later in the season. I could be wrong about that, but just because they're so opposite in so many ways. So I, but, and again, and I know I've said this each podcast, don't care. Donovan, the actor who's playing Dodd, is clearly having so much fun with this part. He's so intense. What I like about him, what his character and the performance reminds me of, it's kind of like when you watch certain actors in certain roles where you feel that they're like a bull in a china shop where they could explode at any moment, and you feel like a kind of tension or energy around them. Russell Crowe like had that a little bit in L.A. Confidential, I thought. You know, when you always think, oh, he could explode at any moment. You have that with this character, except he's a bad guy, which makes it even worse.
And he gets to talk in that just, you know, ridiculous voice. So it must just be, yeah, you can just tell he's just having a blast.
I mean, because actors, be they on the stage, TV, whatever, if they get to have props, if they get to have, you know, whether it be a little bit of makeup, not too much, you know, or a funny hat, or a chunk of a cigar, or the kind of clothing, they love that. Because all that informs and creates the character for them. And yeah, that accent of it, you know, he's enjoying doing that. I don't know how long it took him to really get that down, because you know these shows always have, you know, dialect coaches and who kind of train them on this kind of stuff. But ooh, I mean, maybe I want to wait and see how the rest of the season goes, but he'd be someone I wouldn't mind seeing get a nomination for this right now, when they get to that in the Emmys next year, I guess for the movie/miniseries category. Because now I can care about the category again next year because Fargo will be in it.
But yeah, I get the impression that it may be nice if we'd be able to see some kind of outtakes of him just like, you know, when he's doing his enraged bits, but just him just like deliberately just going completely like crazy and just, you know, just turning up the accent to like 500% and just freaking out for like 5 straight minutes just to get everybody freaking, you know, just laughing.
Oh, yeah. I think when you have a cast like this, you know there's got to be an amazing blooper reel somewhere. this would be a show that if I ever get back into the groove of buying TV shows on DVD or Blu-ray or whatever again, Fargo season 1 and 2, I would love to see what kind of outtakes they have. And this one especially, because they've filled the cast with so many performers who are known more for their comedy chops than their dramatic chops, but they're all doing stellar work here. And I'm definitely looking forward to more we're going to see from this character and this actor. We're only 3 episodes in. We know we're going to see a heck of a lot more. I'm hoping they're not going to kill this guy anytime soon. I hope he makes it to the end. But yeah. You never know on a show like Fargo, quite frankly.
Yeah, and not to keep dipping back to the True Detective well, because I suspect that this isn't going to be during award season. I really don't see this being like a head-to-head between this season of this and that season of that, just because, I mean, it just doesn't seem like the kind of thing that's going to be taken seriously, True Detective, that is. But if you just think about, like, you know, just the supporting cast of this show compared to that show for both seasons, especially the first for True Detective, where they just didn't bother casting, you know, any other characters except the leads. But it's just like, I mean, just the care that they put, just putting together just such an amazing ensemble. It's, you know, it's...
Yeah, they've really clearly delineated each of these characters so that they stand out and they're given something to do and they're memorable. And if you're paying even slight attention, you know who they are and you know what their names are. And I know that sounds like a silly thing, but I'm sorry. I actually do think that's kind of important. When you watched, you know, when you watched the first 7 or 8 episodes of Lost, you knew who everyone's name was. When you watch the first 7 or 8 episodes of Game of Thrones, hard to follow because there's so many of them, but you kind of got who most of their names were. And I always challenge people with True Detective, again, put aside the wonderful cinematography and the great, the truly standout performances by the two leads, Harrelson and McConaughey. I always go, okay, who's the third biggest character? Is it the wife? What's her name? Okay, all right. You spend almost every episode. There's those two cops that are interviewing both of them. Okay, what are their names? No one. And they're in practically every episode. You know, I'm like, Can you give me the names of anyone else? You know, maybe someone might remember the name of the killer because, you know, I personally have forgotten his name at this point. But, and again, I know that sounds silly, but I don't think it is. I think I remember the actress's name because I know the actress, but the wife, is it Michelle, is it Monahan? Is how we pronounce her last name?
Yep.
She plays a pretty key role, although it's a somewhat thankless role. But hey, you know, first seven or eight episodes of every other show that had a wife in it, I know who they were. I know who either would be Betty or Skyler or Lori or whatever wife you want to choose. I still don't know what her name is.
Well, yeah, and then like with this season of True Detective, I mean, you know, it was like halfway through the season before we could remember the names, other than the Colin Farrell character. I mean, so we couldn't remember the names of the fucking characters, even the leads. But this show, I mean, by the second episode, we already had Ed and Peggy and all these other characters just down. So, you know, we'll have to look up, see who the casting person is for this show, give them some props in the next podcast. But just, you know, taking the time to fill out the, you know, just building the world by filling it in the cast with such and solid performers, it really
You know, when it comes to casting for a TV show, I mean, that's no small thing. I mean, they do actually give an Emmy for best casting for a TV series. And especially when you're casting, you know, the entire show. You know, it's not just like season after season where you may have to cast two or three people. Like, no, you're creating a totally new world of characters each time out. So yeah, they do a wonderful job with this show, and you know, there's no one performance that you kind of go, you know, not so great. I mean, some might be a little sillier than others.
Yeah,
but in a weird way, as dark a comedy as the show is, I still can kind of believe all these people. I can kind of believe that all these people exist in this part of the world, this at this time period, whatever. Even if they do things that we may find a bit off or off-putting.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm definitely not familiar with this kind of criminal element in my area, but I mean, I definitely these characters still feel like the kind of people I would see, you know, just like the loose cannon and like, you know, the guy that just stands there eating all the freaking time like Bear, because it's just funny, like every scene we've seen him in, he's just, you know, munching on this, munching on that. Even during the standoff, he like carries out a plate of food or something. It's just rough.
You know what I was thinking about that? I thought about that. I noticed he was always eating. It's like, what is he? Is he like the Brad Pitt in the Ocean movie? Because I think there was I don't know if it's in all three or just the first one. There's kind of a gag with the Brad Pitt character that he's always eating. or something like that. I think that's the story. It's been a while, but I think they always like to have him eating for some reason. And if I'm wrong about that, I apologize, but that's what my memory is dictating to me. Anyway, oh, by the way, so by the end of that scene, the showdown kind of fizzles out after that kid, Charlie, you know, Bear's son, kind of comes out to tell Dodd that Hansi is called, and, you know, it's something that's very important, and to meet him at the dig. I find it interesting that it's okay that he says that in front of the two cops, so there's no concern that they may wonder what's going on and want to follow him out there themselves, because they don't really seem to care about cops here. They're not really worried about them. So, speaking of those two cops, Salverson and Schmidt, they're back in town. He ends up leaving him by that typewriter guy's place. Schmidt makes it kind of clear he doesn't really want any part of this anymore. You know, he doesn't want to follow up about typewriter. And I know his name is Skip Sprang, and I know I love that name, but they actually refer to him as typewriter guy here, which made me kind of happy. So. So he leaves Salverson there, and Salverson walks over to the shop, and he notices that the locks have been kind of, you know, punched out of the door. So he goes inside, and again, this is a space that looks like, you know, it's always under constant renovation or out of business or whatever. But there's a little bit of ruckus going on in the back, and out comes one of those kitchen brothers, and then followed shortly by the other kitchen brother, and of course, Mike Milligan. By the way, as far as gags are concerned, I love that after Salverson actually says that out loud, you know, Mike Milligan and the kitchen brothers, that Milligan's first comment is, "We sound like a prog rock band." Ladies and gentlemen, Mike Milligan and the kitchen brothers. So what I was talking about earlier about dialogue, I think this scene more so than any other scene has some of the most fun and really nicely crafted dialogue for both, you know, tension, character, you name it. And I think a lot of people will automatically gravitate to Mike Milligan's lines, which are definitely are the standout lines. But let's not shortchange Patrick Wilson and the Lou Salverson character. He's got some great lines as well. I mean, he also shows that he's got a bit of a sense of humor as well. Yeah. Although even if he is trying to be stone cold serious here. So like right off the bat, you know, like Milligan recognizes him as a Minnesota cop, and you know this is North Dakota, don't you? without missing a beat, like, yeah, I lost my way. I got lost on the way to the lake or something. I was like, wow. For just a split moment there, he's kind of like channeling Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca, you know, like coming to Casablanca for the waters or something like that. But
yeah, Wilson is really, really great in this scene. I mean, just delivering, you know, those cool kind of, kind of almost badass lines. But like the same time, you can just tell he's like, you know, not super like confident, like, you know, not superhuman, you know, his gun hands right. Shaking a little bit and stuff. And it's just refreshing. You don't know, yeah. You don't need to see somebody that's like, you know, a Terminator.
Right. He's not too cool. He's not cool to the point where you don't believe it. Where it'd be like an action movie star or something like that. Because, you know, he's got the one gun trained on this one or that one, but there's two guys with two big guns on him. So if he pulls that trigger, you know he's gonna get shot. Mm. But as much as we like him, what really kicks the scene is the fact that Mike Milligan likes him. I like this guy. I like you. And he mentions that he met another fellow, big guy, sheriff in Minnesota yesterday. I liked him too. I believe that's when Salverson says, "We're a friendly people." And that's what dialogue. I live to ever write stuff this good if I ever could. When Milligan says, "No, that's not it. Pretty unfriendly, actually." But it's the way you're unfriendly, how you're so polite about it, like you're doing me a favor. That is such good writing. And Milligan pulls it off. He says it. I was saying before about Donovan being possibly an Emmy nominee for supporting actor. Doesn't mean he will. Woodbine also. I mean, hopefully he'll have more to do to really, you know, make sense for it. But he's dynamite on this show. Really getting a kick out of him. Even him doing a Nixon impression, I was able to have fun with. You know, I think he ends the scene with that. I am not a crook. But we get this whole standoff between them, and as our friend, listener, and Facebook follower CJ pointed out, it occurred to me as well. It reminded me of what you said in our previous podcast about how what really makes this show special is that you might have a scene where you know full well the character is going to survive, like Lou Salverson, because we already saw him in season one, you know, 20-something years later. But they will be likely to pull off a scene where we will be frightened for his life. We will be nervous on his behalf, even though we know he's the one character other than, you know, I guess Molly and now Ben Schmidt, who we know they can't kill. And yet it's kind of nerve-wracking because the one thing that the first season of Fargo established – and I think it's not going to be any different with this season. We've seen it a little bit. We haven't seen it as much as I thought we would. I think I got a feeling we're going to see a body count climb in future episodes. Is the joy of an anthology-like series that you can kill pretty much 90-something percent of the people and, you know, and get away with it. So I feel there's going to be a lot of blood in the snow on this show still to come.
Yeah, but yeah, I definitely was And when the scene was over, I'm just like, oh, holy shit, because I'd completely forgotten myself and like the reality of the show, or the, you know, the real world scenario behind it. So just the fact that I was just like, you know, briefly thought that there was a chance that somebody, he might actually get shot there. Just their ability to do that is just to produce that level of tension quality. Right. It's
Exactly. Because if we didn't know that Lou Salverson was going to be in season one as the Keith Carradine character at the diner, if we didn't know that already, it's possible that you could kill this character off and then we end up following, like, say, the Ted Danson character or someone right. else for that matter, or maybe the Blomquist or the people we end up following, although I don't think they're quite the good guys of the show either, quite frankly. More than schmucks, maybe.
But it's definitely, you know, it's a brave thing for the showrunner and the writers to do, just because, you know, we've seen scenes like that fail a zillion times. We're just like, you know, they make it seem like they're going to kill, you know, the main character of the show or something like that, and just like, it just doesn't land at all. Here, you know, they do it better.
Absolutely. So again, that standoff does end, and then we see Salverson is back on the road, and he stops at, you know, this is the late 70s, you know, 79, in fact. So it's a gas line. I thought you'd probably get a big kick out of this moment. I don't know why I thought of you. Because the guy he's talking to, he starts a conversation up with him, the guy's talking about UFOs. He's talking about circles and ovals and patterns. He's talking about, you know, some people think they do like anal probes on us and stuff. You know, he believes they're more of a benevolent, you know, clearly the guy probably saw Close Encounters a year or two earlier. I think he uses the phrase strange happenings, which I think Salverson actually repeats. Of course, this is also going to remind us that we had that weird thing that happened in the premiere episode when Rye saw those inexplicable lights, which were done in a way which I don't know how you explain that away. That didn't look like any sort of weather balloon or whatever.
But, yeah, this scene definitely left me with the strong impression that at some point we're going to see the Carl Weathers have some kind of a UFO type experience, because it just seems like the kind of character that they're going to rope into this. You know, if they take this UFO storyline into any direction at all, it just seems like the kind of character they'd put in there.
Right. That's the Nick Offerman character, right?
Yes.
We already established had a thing about conspiracies and whatnot. So yeah, you're absolutely, that would be the most obvious character to use for it, which almost makes me want them to use someone else, but he'll be so much fun. So why not him? I guess Salverson really didn't feel like getting gas after all, after that, because he gets back in his car and leaves. So maybe he just didn't want to have to deal with this dude anymore. So then we get to, we're nearing the end of the episode. We see the Blomquists are on a bus now. This is when we get that moment of a split screen where we see the characters at different, slightly different points in time. But what's really interesting about this moment, which almost makes me feel like they're showing us, excuse me, not showing us, giving us three points in time, because we're seeing a split screen of them at slightly different points in time on the bus, but we're hearing a voiceover of them having a conversation which has to have taken place at another time, unless we believe they're communicating telepathically. I'm assuming that's not what's happening. But the voiceover, we hear the Blomquist talking about, you know, did it work? Are you sure? You know, of course it worked, whatever, that whole thing. So it's a very interesting choice that they've made. So right now, the only thing I can think that can go wrong is the fact that A, Constance saw their car, or one of them will just trip up saying something that they shouldn't. I don't know. I don't know if there's any other evidence that would lead back to them at this point if he was successful in burning everything, including that shoe, in the fire. So I don't know if there's any other way. But I have to confess, and I won't say what I saw, but I did see scenes from the next episode or future episodes. So I do see ways that they, little things that they didn't think of. But at this moment in time, I didn't think of those myself. So I was thinking, oh, I think they are in the clear. I don't see how they could screw up. Then the trailer showed me how they could screw up.
Yeah, it'll be. I haven't seen it, so it'll be interesting to see. And I definitely would like to. At this point, I mean, there's really, unless they mess up, there's no way that the Gerhards can find out what happened to Rai. I mean, there's no anything. It's just poof, you know, yanked out of nowhere. So, just the it'll be interesting to see what they do with that, for how long they keep it, open.
Beyond that, we see Lou finally does get home. You know, it's late that night, and Sheriff Larson, his father-in-law, is there. I like that he, you know, is telling him about his day. He refers to it as a high noon kind of day, because he kept getting into these weird, standoffs and showdowns during. Huh. And it's kind of a nice little moment. And again, there isn't really any progression of plot or story here other than just a little catch-up. And it's kind of like a nice moment where we see that the sheriff is playing cards with his daughter. I think there's actually an interesting little why it's there, is because we see that. We see Sheriff Larson playing cards with his daughter. And the very next scene, we see Dodd arriving at the dig, and we see how he treats his daughter. He smacks her. They get into a little snippy thing, and he ends up, you know, grabbing her and, you know, and throwing her into the truck rather forcefully. I was thinking she might have a bruise.
Well, yeah, he closed the door on her once. So.
Exactly. I thought he slammed the door on her leg for a second there, which would be pretty bad, but I don't think it was that bad.
I definitely get the feeling that, I mean, you said last week that you thought this character might end up being somewhat important. I think the fact that that she's present for this probably is might have something to do with that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, she's already been playing a part in the story more than, you know, one might have initially suspected. But yeah, and I think there'll be more with her, absolutely. But we discover that Hansi has Skip. Skip Sprang, the typewriter guy. And they want to know, of course, where Rai is. And, you know, Skip don't know. But they give up on him, and they tell him to get in the hole. They've dug a grave for him. It's something right out of he might as well be Saul Goodman at this point. But he's trying to convince them otherwise. You know, he claims that, you know, he can help find them. He knows where he could be. He has capital, and I like that there's that moment where they kind of seem to consider it, and then they're like, nah, you don't know anything. And then they decide to dump. Is that considered asphalt, what that stuff is that you put on the street? Is that what that is?
Yeah, I mean, this is what you use to patch holes. It's not like what you use to, like, make roads. It's just what they dump in, like, you know, potholes. So it's definitely it's a kind of asphalt, but it's more of like a special filler type stuff that.
It looks like the kind of stuff that they use on the streets here in New York and Brooklyn, quite frankly. So that's why I recognized it, and I felt like I could actually almost smell it off the TV screen.
Yeah.
let's face, and then we close on, you know, that steaming pile of asphalt and a little bit of his tie, which we had seen earlier in the episode. I guess it had little American flags on it, you know, sticking up out of the. Out of the asphalt.
Well, yeah, I'm guessing that wearing ties in this part of the country in 1979 must have not been super popular, because, I mean, everybody is just, you know, yanking out and pulling them around. I mean, they definitely, you can just tell that people have, like, no respect for seeing it at all.
Ties are the American flag.
Wow.
Well, we also get reference to, you know, the politics of the era, which everything from, you know, the Watergate and to the malaise of Jimmy Carter, because they're, you know, at this point, 79, Carter's not the most popular guy in the country, because of the everything from the gas lines and everything else. I'm not going to say this was a necessary death. Let's say they really didn't need to kill the guy, but, you know. In a way, I felt it was there just to remind us, hey, you know what? They kill people. Even people who may not really deserve it, they kill people.
So, yeah, it kind of reminded me of when in the first season when Numbers and Wrench just, like, forced that guy through an ice fishing hole for, like, no reason.
Yes. That is exactly like that, actually. Good recall on that. I totally forgot about that. So that was the end of the episode. So... What did you think of this one? I mean, I have a bit of an opinion on it, but let's hear you first. You finished it later than I did, so.
Yeah, I enjoyed it, and it was solid, and nothing super crazy happened, I guess. But what they were doing worked well for me, so I'm really interesting. It'll be just I'm waiting to see what exactly is going to be happening next, and how exactly the situation is going to get out of control.
Right. Well, yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to things escalating week to week on this show, as they did in the first season, and I imagine they're going to, because among many other things, I'm still wondering what episode the Sioux Falls Massacre is actually going to happen in, and exactly what it is. If it's is it a showdown between the Kansas City Mafia and the Gerhardts, or is it something else entirely that we're not even thinking of? As far as this episode is concerned, I mean, on one hand, I enjoyed the hell out of it. Great dialogue, great characters, fun to follow, etc. I probably liked it a tick or two less than the previous two episodes.
Yeah, I definitely like. I can see that. It kind of has a feel of like, this season has an arbitrary event that they have to get to, so it does kind of have just a slight twinge of like, they can't move stuff too fast.
Yeah, this one felt a little. Again, I love there isn't a scene I don't like in the episode. I like watching these characters. I like listening to these characters. I'm fine with that. We come from watching a show which is more about characters and plot to begin with quite often. So I could listen to them talk for an hour or an hour and 12 minutes or whatever it is yet again. But specifically in comparison to the first two episodes, this one, until you get to those like little showdown moments, and that's really all in the last, 10, 12 minutes of the episode, a lot of the episode was catching us up on stuff, informing us. It's entertaining exposition, but it's still exposition. It's still just, so in a way, the episode's kind of, when I said earlier, and I didn't mean it as a criticism of the show as a whole at all, but there's kind of a static feeling about this episode for me. Again, we're talking about, grades of if I was giving letter grades or whatever, or number grades, we're only talking about a point or two lower than the last two, but better than most things I'll be watching on television over the coming week. So,
right.
And I enjoyed the hell out of it. And those scenes at the end, especially the confrontation between Salverson and Mike Milligan and the Kitchen Brothers, was a great payoff for the episode. But I'm looking forward to see it get just a little bit crazier in later episodes.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I got, you watch the first season week to week, and I watched it, in just one giant burst of like glorious, bloody, snowy violence. But were there episodes like this in the first season? Like, I mean, I know there were, but did it really feel like that was happening? Whether it was just, kind of a little bit lull episodes in between, and then
cause yes.
For me, just, for me.
There a little bit. I mean, the interesting thing with season one was, and what made it unique was we were going to watch one character that we initially thought one way about, and then from week to week we saw the progression or degression or regression. I guess I don't know what the right word is right now of a character, and we say, oh, the guy I thought we were supposed to be kind of feeling bad for, rooting for, is getting worse week after week after week. So we're seeing his transformation. It's kind of like watching Breaking Bad, but instead of over five seasons, they compressed it all in a few episodes, so you have a couple of threads like that, as well as, the two different cops that we follow, whatever. But there were certain episodes that kind of lulled a little bit, especially when they whenever they got too much involved with the Oliver Platt storyline with the supermarket guy.
Yeah,
that was probably one of the weaker parts of the season. Still fun, but not as good as the rest of it. But yeah, I wasn't watching it with that in mind. As far we're podcasting about it, so it's harder for me to evaluate in that sense. But I feel like there were. But more because I can remember the standout episodes more. And there are several standout episodes in season one. So I'm looking forward to the ones that are going to really like pop and stand out for this season. I think all three of these have been fantastic. You know, we're all in the A category, just about. You know, we're just talking about A's and A minuses. You know, at worst, maybe I might give it a B plus, but I'm thinking, you know what, that dialogue's so good, I'm going to give it an A minus anyway, because it's just so good.
Yeah, so. I'm really looking forward to presumably sometime in the next few weeks when they'll have that one like really standout episode like the one last year with the blizzard. I'm just assuming that they're gonna have a, you know, something like that, just like a completely big old wow, knock our socks off episode soonish. So,
well, we know they're gonna have to have at least one like that, and maybe it won't necessarily be the Sioux Falls Massacre, although we. They've already built that up now that it better be insane. And we also have the high point of insanity or silliness to be looking forward to, because as I believe we've spoken about, and you should know that Bruce Campbell is slated to appear as Ronald Reagan on this show, which sounds about as insane an idea as I've ever heard for any TV series, much less this one. I'm dying to see how they pull that off where it doesn't like totally take me out of the show, but it's Bruce. I love Bruce Campbell anyway. He's, you know, cult figure that I've loved in movies and TV shows. I love the idea of him as Reagan. So
yeah, well, I love the idea of some like, you know, whiny pussy commentator like Sean Hannity, like freaking out about it on Fox News after the fact. Oh, look, they're disrespecting great Ronald Reagan. Ah, these damn liberal TV show people, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, fuck you. I'm looking forward to seeing the inevitable complaining about that.
Which is especially funny considering that, you know, Fox News and FX are all part of the same overall conglomerate. So
yeah,
he may want to be careful about that, or maybe he won't care. All right. I think that's about as much as I wanted to say about the episode. So unless there's anything else you wanted to say.
Oh, we got her all out good there. And it's funny because we started recording this in the the beginning and the bottom of the ninth of the Game 1 of the World Series, and now it's like the top of the 13th and the game is still on. So I suspect there's going to be some tired-ass Mets fans waking up in a few hours over there.
Yes, I'm sure I'll be running into them, you know, on the bus or on the train or whatever, all wearing the little Metsy hats. But, I'm impressed that we were able to make it through the whole podcast, and I didn't switch gears and start talking about the Walking Dead after all, which I had threatened to do before our podcast. We'll save that for our geeky podcast, which is obviously where it belongs. But I'll just say right now, he's not dead. Anyway, so let's do our little wrap up. So if you enjoyed this podcast and enjoy talking about shows like Fargo or The Flash, or pretty much any dramatic or even comedy series that's on TV right now, you can find us on Facebook. We're the Serious TV Drama Podcast. Type in Serious TV Drama in the search box. You should find us that way. The same goes for iTunes. We would love to get as many subscribers as we can on iTunes. So type Serious TV Drama in the search box there. We will pop up. You can like us. You can rate us. We would love 5-star ratings whenever possible. It raises our profile when people are searching for podcasts about shows like a Fargo or a Flash or etc. And last but not least, because I usually lead with it, if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, we do have a Twitter account. It's at STVD. It's the letters stand for Serious TV Drama. STVD Podcast. I sometimes will send out our links to our podcast as well as occasionally we'll comment on other TV or movie matters. I don't do it quite as much as I should, but, you know, I'm tired.
there's only so much time, so.
Yeah, I mean, I was so happy that my DVR, I was looking at my DVR before, it was like, earlier the other day, I was like, oh, I got it only down to 6%. That's so awesome. It's like nothing. And then I realized, oh, I got a whole new DVR, which has like, you know, 10 times more memory than the previous one did, because I was like, 6%? And that still represents, I was like, 10, 12, 15, 18. I still got 20-something shows to watch. Are you kidding me? Oh. So I may be looking forward to when shows go on hiatuses just to catch up on stuff.
Yeah. I know the feeling.
All right. So I guess at this point we should just say goodnight. And thanks for listening to our Fargo podcast. If you're into the geeky stuff, we will be recording a special podcast about Flash and the latest entry in superhero TV, Supergirl, which debuted last night. I don't think you haven't gotten the chance to watch it yet, have you?
No, I haven't watched either one yet.
So you'll be watching that tomorrow just before we get to recording. So if you like that sort of stuff, you will find that on our Facebook page and on our feed as well at some point later this week. I've never actually said that on any of our podcasts. It's kind of nice to promote our other podcast for a change.
Yeah, plus we have great co-hosts for those ones, so it's always nice to get on there and have some other people talk instead of us two, know-it-all assholes.
Well, it's nice just to be able to save some energy and breath every once in a while. Which is, I know it's weird to hear me say that because, I do love to hear the sound of my own voice. Anyway, and like I said, like I had mentioned earlier, at least I think I did, we, much like Better Call Saul or even going back to Mad Men, we do tend to like to end our podcasts of this nature usually picking a piece of music that was used in the episode. And this episode did have a great score, as I think it always does. And there was at least one or two songs that caught my ear. But based on the events of the episode and one character in particular, I found something else I thought would be amusingly appropriate to end our podcast. So as we say goodnight, I hope you enjoy the little tune we've got lined up for you.
All right, sounds good. I guess goodnight, everybody. Goodnight, Scott.
Goodnight, Dan.